Rick Ganley, this is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Like so many newspapers nationwide, New Hampshire's largest newspaper, The Union Leader, has been forced to make huge changes to survive in the digital age. It's struggled with how to make online content profitable. It's reduced expenses by reducing staff. And just recently, it outsourced its printing operations, although not far. The paper's now printed on the seacoast instead of at its headquarters in Manchester. But despite the tough times, The Union Leader is celebrating this year. It's the paper's 150th birthday. And in observing this sesquicentennial, it's publishing a book looking back at its many years of coverage, from Lincoln's assassination to two world wars, from the great textile strikes to the state's starring role in selecting our nation's president. The book will also include slices of Granite State cultural life, from New Hampshire's Olympic athletes to the old man tumbling down. And it'll talk about the paper itself, especially its influential and controversial role in New Hampshire politics, including, of course, the famous fiery front-page editorials of longtime publisher and conservative icon William Loeb. Today in The Exchange, we look back at 150 years of the New Hampshire Union Leader, the events it's reported on, and the paper's own role in the Granite State, sparking conversation and at times controversy. Let's hear from you, too. How do you see the Union Leader's legacy in our state after 150 years? If you're a regular reader, how have you seen the paper change in more recent times? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. With me in studio, Joe McQuaid, publisher and president of the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. And Joe, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, you're very much welcome, Laura. Happy to be on the show.
Charlie Perkins is also with us. He was an editor at the Union Leader for almost 30 years. Currently, he's managing partner of North Village Media, and he is putting together that book I mentioned called New Hampshire, 150 Years. And Charlie, good to see you too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much.
And joining us by phone is Michael Dupre, professor of sociology emeritus at St. Anselm College. He's also a senior research fellow at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics and Political Library. And Michael Dupre, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Pleased to be here, Laura. Thank you.
Well, Joe, I want to start with you. And boy, it's going to be hard to get through 150 years in 1 hour, but we'll do our best. Start at the beginning, if you could, please, Joe. 150 years back, just remind us where the state, where the nation were at when this paper was founded in the early 1860s.
I tweeted last night, because that's all we do now is Twitter for communication, that I would be happy to take the first 75 years where I was around as a kid reporter, and Charlie could take the rest. And Charlie actually gets the kudos for not only doing the book, but suggesting how we do the book, that it not be 150 years of a newspaper, but 150 years of New Hampshire as seen through the eyes of a newspaper that has been around and reporting it. And it started actually before a daily. It's been a daily since March 31st, 1863. It was a weekly on and off for at least 10 years before that. And we trace a fiery editor named Campbell to bringing it on board as a daily and keeping it that way. But there were Union soldiers going off to the Civil War who were bivouacked in Manchester one fine day, reading editorials in the Morning Union by this guy Campbell, and they marched on his house with rope in hand.
Why?
Because he was for letting the South go, didn't think a lot of Lincoln. The Union and now Leader have been controversial since day one, swinging from Democrat to conservative and back and forth. We've had people who ran for president on the paper. This guy, Frank Knox, came to New Hampshire to see Charlie Bass's grandfather, who was the governor, to get him to back a guy named Teddy Roosevelt, who was running again for president in 1912. That didn't work out, but Knox came to Manchester and founded the Leader and then bought the Union a couple of years later, ran for president, was Secretary of the Navy to FDR in that war. So we've not only covered New Hampshire history, but because of the location and because of the presidential primary, we've been a part of that history right along.
That's an amazing story about the soldiers going to the publisher's house.
He was taken out of town and urged by the publisher to keep quiet for a few weeks, and then he came back. He moved to Florida and came back and died in Henniker, New Hampshire, quietly in the 1870s. And then a guy named Stilson Hutchins owned the paper, and he left here and founded a little paper in Washington called the Washington Post. New Hampshire, forget the Union leader, the Los Angeles Times was founded by a guy from New Hampshire named Frank Otis. There was a guy named Horace Greeley who I think went to New York and started a
fame
little paper
in the journalistic world.
Right. And that's the fun part of working at the paper is all the national angles. Right now we're rooting for the Pittsburgh Pirates to be against the Red Sox because it will be the first all-New Hampshire general manager matchup for baseball because of the two general managers.
Charlie Perkins, what's it been like for you going through 150 years of headlines?
What struck me is the paper's history does break into eras. It's not a steady, smooth transition from one decade to the next. The paper, as Joe just explained, started as a raucous, rollicking political entity. From day one, it was a strong pro-democratic paper, stayed that way into the late 1800s when there was a sharp shift. The paper became more progressive Republican in the early 20th century. People have forgotten that. People think of the Union leader, understandably, for the conservative editorial policies it's had since 1946.
When William Loeb took over.
Exactly. But before William Loeb came into the picture, the first part of the 20th century, under Frank Knox's guidance, this was a paper which was very active in progressive Republican circles. Leadership of Knox, a man who went on to run the Chicago newspapers and become perhaps as well-known a national figure in his day as William Loeb was 40 years later, shows the paper has not been one constant, steady stream of one ideology. It has changed with the times.
Yeah, and let's talk about that William Loeb era, though, because I think a lot of folks listening right now, that's the era that they remember. And Michael Dupre, you've done a lot of research on William Loeb and his influence on state politics. Just remind us what William Loeb's philosophy was when it came to his role and the paper's role in the state.
William Loeb is an interesting individual in terms of his work at the paper. I must say, his first editorial that I found was, in December of 1946, which actually he was in support of a student driver education for classes around New Hampshire, which I found interesting. But by 1950, he was hitting the front page. His first front page editorial was, I believe, in April of 1950, and that was dealing with communism and Truman's weakness on communism. What Loeb did, what I'm finding here, is that basically, he took the major issues of the day, and he simplified them for a working-class group of people in Manchester and throughout the state. I mean, the way he wrote, it was colorful, and people could identify with it. He could put a fear on the face of communism in the 50s with the Rosenbergs, the McCarthy era, the civil rights movement, Vietnam, anti-war in the 60s, women's movement, gay liberation. In the 70s. So he kind of set the tone, the political view of the Union leader, set the tone in the state for the state politics. And with the national primary starting, the first presidential primary in 1952, the Union leader and Loeb took on a national flavor in terms of influencing the candidates that came in here. He could either make or break many a presidential candidate.
Well, I definitely want to ask all of you about the influence of the Union leader in our presidential selection process. But just sticking with the state's political culture for a minute, Michael, like you said, he took on the major issues of the day and made them understandable. Some say he's a big part of the reason New Hampshire has no broad-based sales or income tax and is credited in large measure for helping push forward the state's first lottery.
No doubt about that. Matter of fact, back in 1952, he had an editorial dealing with the no sales tax, no income tax, supporting then the nominee Hugh Gregg for governor as well as the job that Bert Teague was doing in the Republican Party as chairman, of making sure that there wouldn't be a sales or an income tax in New Hampshire. And he, you know, over the years just kept going at that. I think he reached his peak in 1972 with the election of Meldrum Thompson. Keep in mind that the influence of Loeb since since 1972, every governor has taken the pledge against the sales and income tax, except, well, two in 1970. One was Walter Peterson, who was defeated in a primary. I believe he took the pledge but changed his mind looking at a tax. But by 1972, Walter Meldrum Thompson had defeated him in the primary. Hugh Gallon also had not taken the pledge. Every Democratic governor has taken the pledge. The last three Democratic governors have taken the pledge against the sales or income tax.
Actually, Joe's shaking his head there. I think Jean Shaheen in her last run, Joe,
did not take the pledge last time.
No, I'm saying their first runs. When they first ran, the Democratic governors, the Democratic candidates did take the pledge. By their second or third term, right, they did kind of phase it out or not mention it, right?
Well, Michael, I have one last question for you, and I wonder how you think this style of William Loeb, this sort of no-holds-barred editorial writing on the front page, is reflected in our time. How do we see this in our time, in our current media era?
Well, I think in our time, I think he's, in many ways, he was the harbinger of many of these talk celebrities. You look at Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Chris Matthews. These people, they're out there and they're colorful, and they have their positions, whether you like them or not. I think Loeb basically started that. I mean, if you look at some of the rhetoric he used. He called the president Dopey Dwight Eisenhower, Jerry the Jerk. He looked at Muskie in his campaign in '72. He called him Moscow Muskie. Moscow Muskie. Many have said that not only the crying, but the way he went after Muskie, he crippled him for the nomination as time went on.
So that's a forerunner of some of the journalism we see today.
I would think so, yes.
All right. Michael, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
That's Michael Dupre, again, professor of sociology emeritus at St. Anselm College, senior research fellow at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics and Political Library. More on 150 years of the New Hampshire Union leader after a super short break. And we'll start hearing from you at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And October 15th is a deadline for us to wrap up the NHPR Sustaining Member Challenge. When 500 listeners become sustainers by the 15th, NHPR is going to be receiving $10,000 from the Mackinich Foundation, and we'll be canceling a day from our upcoming fall fund drive. But we need you to become a sustaining member to help support the new service you rely on at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Miles Smith Farm in Loudoun, inviting families Sunday, October 13th from 10 to 4 to its annual Farm Day. Featuring local foods, local vendors, cow rides, and family fun, milesmithfarm.com. And Antioch University New England, offering purpose-driven and practice-based graduate and certificate programs to empower students who want to lead change. Information at antiochne.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the legacy of 150 years of the Union leader. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. How do you see the Union leader's legacy in our state after 150 years? If you're a regular reader, how have you seen the paper change in more recent times? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, a couple questions for you before we go to our listeners. It was interesting to hear Michael Dupre really talk about the Loeb era. And Charlie Perkins, I wonder what your thoughts are on what Michael said about how William Loeb, in one sense, kind of was a forerunner of some of the media that we see today.
I think he filled the gap between the more combative media of the 19th century and the media we see today. I think we had an era in the last two-thirds of the 20th century in which typical media present itself as above the fray, tried to take a different tone, a less populist tone. William Loeb never bought that argument. He was very happy to continue to bring his opinions clearly labeled onto page one in a style that was familiar back then, meaning the 19th century, and is familiar through TV and the internet today.
Yeah, and what about him being credited with so many state policies, Joe? I mean, the lack of an income tax, the fact that we had the nation's first lottery. Also, some say that the union leader was very involved in the question of whether to have an oil refinery on the seacoast, the Onassis oil refinery.
That didn't work out.
But what about his impact on the state's political culture? I'd love to hear what you think.
I think it was huge. The pledge not to have a broad-based sales or income tax originated with the union leader. Hugh Gregg used it in his one term as governor. Sherman Adams had been governor before Gregg and had said in a headline that my dad had in his Sunday paper that if we don't have a sales tax immediately, that's it for New Hampshire. We're all dead. And that was in 1951. And it's gone ever since. The professor mentions Governor Walter Peterson. He did not take the pledge when he sought a third term. He said he would go to the mat against broad-based taxes, and that was clearly not enough for Republicans in the primary. Loeb in front page editorials is interesting because he didn't start out having a front page editorial every day of the week. Far from it. In the 50s, he became more regular. And then as the national media caught on to him, he felt an obligation, I think, to fill the front page every day with an editorial, every day but Sunday.
And that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, usually editorials are reserved for the inside, the editorial page, where all the, you know,
where
opinion pieces are.
Them,
and, right. Yeah, and that's why he put them on the front, right, John?
Yes, exactly. And that's why one of his managers suggested that they put the editorial page on the front of a section at the time, which lasted for a good number of years as well.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions, comments, thoughts about the union leader as it observes this 150th birthday, covering the news of New Hampshire, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And let's go first, gentlemen, to Rod in Dover. Hi, Rod. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. My name's Rod Paul. I used to be the political editor of the Concord Monitor, and I wanted to ask Charlie and Joe whether they think their old boss, Bill Loeb, was as powerful as he is conventionally portrayed. My sense of him was that he was what many publishers were, frankly, around the country in our long history of journalism, which was very, very feisty and outspoken, whether you agreed with him or not, and I did not for most of the time. But the way to judge the union leader was more often, in my mind, at least here in New Hampshire, whether they actually provided the news. And I think that's actually a more important issue. The Bill Loeb issue is sort of fancy and flamboyant. But the real issue is, did they provide the news?
Well, and do you think they did, Ron?
I think it depends who was writing the article. There were some reporters back in the day, Art Egan, Warren Pease, books like that, who about whom you might have one opinion. And there were other reporters, frankly, like Don Tibbetts or D. Frank O'Neill, who I knew fairly well, all of them, who you'd read because you could find out what was going on. And then you'd have reporters who were up in the North Country. You wouldn't know anything else about the state from the North Country, except that they were up there, and you usually got a pretty good idea of what was going on.
Well, Rod, it's good to hear from you, and former editor of the Concord Monitor, a worthy foe sometimes on the editorial pages. I'd love to hear from both of you on this.
Well, he was a political reporter for the Concord Monitor, and he really got Loeb and then-Governor Thompson upset when Rod asked for, under the state's right-to-know laws, I guess, for phone records from the governor's office. And there were a lot of phone records from the governor's office to Pride's Crossing, Massachusetts, which is where William Loeb lived. And Rod tried to suggest that they came at the moments of particular legislation or particular big issues, and that somehow these calls, Thompson was calling Loeb for his advice. I don't think that was the case. I think it was mostly Thompson calling Loeb to get public relations for something that he had just done, and Loeb was happy to give him the public relations. I knew what Rod was going to say about the reporters. Egan and Pease were investigative reporters and took up issues that the conservative wanted to take up. And D. Frank O'Neill and Don Tibbetts, Laura, you probably ran into Don as well.
Yes, I remember Don.
Were simply straight down the middle reporters of fact in Concord. And the state coverage that Rod talks about was really great, and we try to maintain it today. And before New Hampshire Public Radio got towers all over the place, and before somebody with some money bought Channel 9, the Union Leader was the only statewide source of information and relied upon by a lot of people.
You know, I like his point about, he says, why is there all this, you know, influence or attention on Loeb, quibbling with how influential Loeb really was? Rod says, Charlie Perkins, it's more important to talk about whether the reporters were covering the news or not. I wonder, why so much attention? When you mention Union Leader, everybody says, the editorials, William Loeb. I've traveled around the country and told people I was from New Hampshire, and older people will say, oh, William Loeb. So why so much attention on that instead of the statewide coverage and some fine journalists like Don Tibbetts?
I think because William Loeb was happy to be a lightning rod. He was happy to be the public face of the newspaper. He understood that he had powers both through his writing and through his personality that could strengthen the newspaper and strengthen the conservative cause. But he also knew that without the solid foundation of state news, that was going to go nowhere. He made sure that the money kept getting pumped back into the operation to give us the statewide network of correspondents, the high-quality reporters, such as one of the people who affected me the most in this business, Don Tibbetts.
Former longtime State House bureau chief. Yeah,
only so good they named the press room after him.
Wow.
Yes. Without that base of skilled reporting, the editorials wouldn't have had their clout. William Loeb always knew that.
Okay, so here's one more question stemming from Rod's call. He said, or you mentioned in your response to that, Joe, that Egan and Pease were investigative reporters who took up conservative causes, whereas people like Don Tibbetts more, you know, played it straight down the line. Do you still do that? Do you still have investigative reporters who take up certain causes?
We try to look at issues from all sides, and I think conservatives would say that a lot of issues don't get the full look that they should. So when I look at the news and issues, I ask questions that, because I happen to be conservative, are more likely to be asked. But the funny thing about William Loeb's influence and the influence the paper still has because of our conservative ideology, and Loeb had some exceptions to his, the newsroom and the editors, Mr. Perkins and his replacement, and the reporters, I think, try to bend over backwards to be fair in the news columns to get all sides of the story.
So you're saying it's different than it was perhaps in Loeb's era?
I think it is, yeah.
Charlie?
Well, I worked both under William Loeb and in later years under his widow, Naki Loeb, and under Joe McQuaid. Under all those publishers, I felt the same pressure to double up on the fairness I hope I always had as a professional. I knew the paper was making enemies through its editorial pages. I felt as though I was working in a spotlight. The whole newsroom worked in a spotlight. And as a young reporter, that bothered me. I thought it was unfair. I was being held to unfair high standards. Once I got a little older and wiser, I realized that's a good thing. Any pressure that makes you be very careful to be a straight-down-the-middle news reporter or news editor is good pressure.
Here's an email that just came in from Kathy, who says, Bill Loeb was a racist and let his feelings be known far and wide in editorials and general policies. He was behind the times on this issue. To the extent that the announcement in the 60s of my engagement with a photo to a mixed-race man prompted a personal letter from the Citizens Council, a segregationist organization, against my marriage. Catherine says, Loeb did a lot of harm in this state on this issue. Seemed like we were living in Mississippi, not New Hampshire. I have also read that William Loeb, Joe McQuaid, went after gay students at UNH. So there were some issues where, these social issues where he seems very behind the times. And she says seemed behind the times even at that time.
William Loeb had an advisory board of citizens of New Hampshire that got together once a month to give him ideas and what was happening in the state. And one of its members was a Dr. Merrin Fort from the University of New Hampshire, who was a black fellow whose studies, I think, were in sociology. And he was controversial on the UNH campus because he was a conservative. One of William Loeb's longtime national columnists was a gentleman named George Schuyler, who happened to be a black man from Harlem. Loeb liked to take credit for a Vietnam War correspondent who worked for us and others named Philippa Schuyler, who was a concert pianist but loved writing. George's daughter, she worked for us in Vietnam. William Loeb was not a racist. William Loeb was from a different era entirely. He never would attack gay students, but he was from the era when gay was out of the norm and was not accepted, and so that would be a natural for Loeb. It's funny about fairness in the newsroom. Loeb loved to quote a guy named Eugene McCarthy, who in editorials Loeb had called on the front page a skunk, in the headline, a skunk, and then made it a skunk skunk. When McCarthy wrote a book about the 1968 presidential run, he cited the Union Leader editorials as being against him, but the Union Leader news coverage as being better than others in terms of reporting what he was doing. And my dad's former co-founder of the Sunday News was Gene McCarthy's campaign manager.
Wow.
A guy named Blair Clark.
Connections everywhere, huh?
Oh, yeah. Give me a couple of hours.
Right. Well, Kathy, thank you for the email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And joining us now, gentlemen, is Guy McMillan, former longtime editorial page writer for the Keene Sentinel. And Guy, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, Laura. Hello, everybody.
Well, and welcome back. It's been a while since we talked. And Guy, you've had your disagreements over your many years at the Keene Sentinel with the Union Leader. I love your thoughts, though, Guy, on how you think the Union Leader has shaped New Hampshire's political culture.
Well, I'm not sure that it's had as much influence as some of its supporters think, but it certainly was getting, and still does get, a lot of attention around the state. I grew up reading the Union Leader in the late 50s and in the 60s and 70s. And I think the problem it had, you know, Don Tibbetts aside, is that much of the newspaper seemed, at least to the readers, this reader, seemed marinated in right-wing ideology. And that means not just the front page editorials, which, fine, you know, it's your newspaper, but also the news and the headlines and the subjective source or subjective decisions as to what news or information was going to be covered. And I would say, I'm here this morning to say that much of this has evolved over the last several decades, and I think now the Union Leader is a pretty fine statewide newspaper. It's conservative, but wonderful. That's not my cup of tea, but I'll drink it. What I didn't like before was not knowing whether I was getting somebody's spin on a story or whether I was getting the information.
So now you feel like you're getting the information.
Well, I tell you, you go back to August something or other, when they did a three-part series on the Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act. Don, what was his name, Galloway? No. Anyway, they did a series on that, the Health Care Act and its impact on New Hampshire. And it was the best thing I've read on that subject. Dave Solomon,
yes.
Best thing I've read on that subject. Now, anyone who reads the opinion pages knows what the Union Leader thinks of the Health Care Act, but that three-part series was something the people of New Hampshire needed and still need. I could give you another story on that, but I'll wait. Needed to know about this thing. All they hear is opinion, and there are a lot of facts involved in that. So I would say that kind of reporting, and a lot of other things that you read in the Union Leader today, are really quite remarkably good.
The Keene Sentinel, and your editorials in particular, Guy, are known for being left of center. The union leader, obviously, we've talked a lot this hour already about its editorials being right of center. Have there ever been any times when your two papers agreed?
Oh, yeah. I can't think of what they are, but I can remember Drew Klein raising an eyebrow once when I met him. The sort of surprise that we agreed on. And the union
Drew Klein,
leader,
by the way, is the current editorial page writer. Yeah,
that's
go ahead,
right,
Guy.
I'm sorry, yeah. The union leader and the Keene Sentinel probably have a certain libertarian bent on many issues, and probably do agree on a lot of things. And we could go back and pick them out, although I'm right now not prepared to cite any. But the difference today, if you read the union leader today, or the Sentinel, at least when I was there, and I think it's still carrying on, there's not an awful lot of personal bitterness, nastiness, innuendo, you know. But mostly, it's an opinion thing with the facts behind the opinions clearly laid out, so that the reader can read the opinion, digest the facts, and say, well, I agree with that or I disagree with that, without having to go into a conniption fit, as was the case, at least in my household, with many of the Loeb editorials.
Well, Guy, just to wrap up with you before the break, if we could. So 150 years, here we are. What would you say the legacy is of the union leader over this past century and a half? It seems pretty unbelievable that this paper got started around the Civil War.
Yeah, I like the first era thing. I think if we'd let the South go, they could have attacked Iraq, and we could have had dinner with the Canadians, and it would have been a nice different thing. But it's too late for that now. I think it's interesting. I think that Loeb was such a towering figure with his vituperative nature that that's all we think of, and it's been mentioned a lot on here. But I would say that there are aspects of the union leader that people aren't aware of, and I think that, as I say, in the last decade or two, you've got at least one liberal on the editorial page, Roger Simon's column. You've got stories and articles that don't necessarily toe the line. So I would say that, I don't know about the legacy, but I would say that if we can take care of the economic challenges that face all the newspapers these days, the future looks bright.
Well, perfect segue to what we're going to talk about. Coming up after a short break, some of the financial challenges that papers face these days. And Guy McMillan, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Laura.
Guy McMillan, former longtime editorial page writer for the Keene Sentinel. We'll be back after a short break, and when we do come back, we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, strong interest, technical glitches, and other rollout challenges for the new health insurance exchanges. Then a conversation with neurologist and best-selling author Oliver Sacks. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric. Now offering electrical repair and service in addition to furnaces, boilers, and water heaters. Online at justcallheritage.com. And Concord Regional Visiting Nurse Association Hospice, providing specialized end-of-life care for terminally ill people and bereavement and grief support for their families. CRVNA.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at 150 years of the New Hampshire Union Leader. Started as the Manchester Daily Union in the years leading up to the Civil War, it grew to be the state's largest newspaper. And we're looking at some of the issues it's covered over the years, how the paper itself has been at the center of some controversy, and at the legacy of this long-running source of news and information here in New Hampshire. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. If you read the Union Leader regularly, how do you think the paper has changed in more recent times? Also, as we look back over 150 years, what do you think the union leader's legacy is in our state? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, or send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's go right back to our listeners. And Mary's calling from Concord. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. I want to say thank you for all those wonderful political cartoons. I enjoy them, and they're very up-to-date and on the current subject.
Well, and a talented political cartoonist can say it in a picture. That picture is worth 1,000 words. You know, actually curious, Joe, about that. You guys used to have your own cartoon
artist.
Yes,
we had a couple for years.
Yeah, you don't now.
That was one of the downsizings because of the economy. She may be referring to some of the nationally syndicated ones that we use, which really pop. There's a guy who used to write a cartoon strip for me who still does an occasional cartoon for the Concord Monitor named Mike Marland.
Oh, he is the Concord Monitor's
well, he had a
main cartoonist.
I gave him his break with a comic strip called RFD.
Interesting.
Years ago. But we had two guys, and they were great, and I loved working with the cartoonists because you can say a lot in one image, but we haven't had that. We have an occasional freelancer. It's mostly syndicated.
And following up on what you said, we had to do that, had to let that go in an era of cost-cutting. Guy McMillan also mentioned at the end of his conversation with us, Charlie Perkins, the real financial struggles of the news business, and especially newspapers, because you're still kind of trying to crank out that paper product. What are some of the big changes that you've seen, Charlie, in the way that newspapers do business, given the challenges of online media and so forth?
I think part of it is coming to terms with the idea that you no longer can tell the story of your city or your state in 24-hour chunks. You're now a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week news operation, combining the power of, in this case, print with a very powerful website. It may not be digital first everywhere at all times, but digital is there shoulder to shoulder with print and, as we all know, moving in front.
So how do you make it pay? That's been the struggle. And I know the union leader's gone back and forth on, you know, whether to charge for content and the paywall. And I mean, every paper has struggled with this, not just you guys.
We haven't really gone back and forth. And Charlie was the guy who really developed us on the web. But what we did on the web was only put up a very small number of stories for free. And when we had the ability and a new content management system was put into place, then we could put up everything with ease, but you can only see a certain number of stories before you're asked to register and after that to contribute. But, you know, the question you ask, when you find the answer to that, or Mr. Bezos does with the Washington Post, please let me know.
Oh,
It's the newspaper industry struggle. I would dare say we have as many people reading us now as we ever had, but they're reading us in little bits online, and they're looking at headlines online, and younger generations are only interested in headlines or social media, so we're trying to get ahead of them on social media. I've got veteran reporters like John DeStazo who got it right away, and I can't keep him off the internet. He's always updating his column with political bits and pieces. But I have to explain to the newsroom that the print papers, Charlie says, once every 24 hours, that's more an explainer now of what happened and what's coming, not breaking news, because breaking news is over in an instant. That guy, by the way, Dave Solomon is the one that Guy McMillan mentioned. He used to be the editor at the National Telegraph and got downsized, and we were lucky to pick him up. And that kind of series on Obamacare is what a newspaper can and should be doing.
Yeah, those in-depth reports that Dave does on that and other issues. And yet, Charlie, so if people have to pay for that online, right, they can only read a little bit of what Dave has done on Obamacare, then they have to pay for the rest? Is that how it works?
The union leader has a system now where you can see a few full stories. After that, the paywall kicks in, if I understand it properly.
And how does that work? How's that working for you guys?
Joe,
it's not
you
working for
that.
It's not working for Charlie. Charlie got out when he saw what was happening to the news business, I think. It's working okay. It's not as much online digital subscriptions, nearly as much as print. But it's getting the information out. And we are actually making money on the website with web advertising because we approach advertisers and say, you know, you can do Google AdWords for pennies, but you might show up on a site in Bangladesh. If you want to get before a local audience, you want to be with the local news provider where people go on a steady and consistent basis. As a result of that, we have a lot of our local advertisers, the insurance companies, the hospitals.
Sure, those local companies that want those local eyeballs.
The TV station advertising on our online homepage.
Our phone number for you to join us again is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange. We want your questions, comments, thoughts on this 150-year look back at the New Hampshire Union Leader. What do you think the legacy of the paper has been in our state? Again, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Charlie, I'd love your thoughts too on Joe's comment on younger readers and what they want. How do you think the public's appetite for news has changed?
I think there's a very limited connection now geographically to one's home area. And that, to me, is the biggest single change. People now are apt to define themselves as much by a circle of friends or interests that has very little to do with the 603 area code. The Union Leader was able to maximize the era in which people really cared what happened in northern Grafton County or over in the Monadnocks or down in the Seacoast. And that's what they saw as number one. That was their world. There's less of that now. And the Union Leader, like papers across the country, is trying to find ways, I believe, to continue to be the state paper without being tied improperly to a somewhat outdated social idea of what people's lives are about.
Now, that's interesting. Pick up a little bit more on that. So you're saying we're less geographic than we used to be?
I think so. And I think that the use of social media particularly, which the impact of that cannot be overstated. The ability of people to have a circle of not just friends but influencers who are not in just Greater Manchester or just in Rockingham County, but reaching across the country, across national lines, and throughout their lives, reaching back to high school and college days, casual professional acquaintances, all these sources of information are now available through social media, providing news tips, providing information about pop culture, about lifestyle issues that these people care about. It's customized in a way that no newspaper, no one edited news source can provide. The trick now for media is to try to find out what parts of the old still remain important to a younger generation, which parts are going to have to be set aside, and how to reach out to be part of the new developing worlds.
And how do you not anger your older readers by making some of those changes?
There is probably no way to do that. Change is always difficult for any company. For a company that has customers who have been there for decades, it's all the tougher. It's a very delicate dance.
Joe, you look like you want to jump in. Go ahead.
No, I'm just smiling because Charlie's absolutely correct. Older readers want one thing. Younger readers, if they want something, it's completely different. Social media is frightening in the narrowness of what young people get. They get their news a lot from their Facebook friends, so it's only the selections that their Facebook friends are interested in, not the broader range that they a news media organization offers them. So it's really challenging times. I don't know of anything since electricity that has changed the world so much as the internet. And I was stunned that the Graham family in Washington sold the Washington Post. When my wife told me it had been sold to Jeff Bezos from Amazon, I said, "Now you must mean the Washington Times or something, not the Post." But I'm hopeful that Bezos, who comes from the internet world, can figure out ways to slice and dice that modern audience to help news organizations like ours continue.
So everybody's watching him really closely.
Yeah, yeah, they really
seeing
are.
What he comes up with. All right, let's take another call if we could. Steve's been waiting in Keene. Hi, Steve, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, I'm a reader, a longtime reader of the Union Leader and love the paper, but I all this cost-cutting, I feel the Union Leader's strong suit was its regional correspondence. So I live in Keene, but I'd like to know what's going over on the Seacoast where I lived for a while in the North Country, and I kind of miss the days when you had intrepid reporters like Mark Hayward and Gary Dennis out there and had some really nice coverage. The Union Leader always kind of countered the local daily, which was the local daily would be more deferential to local power interests, and I could always appreciate the Union Leader, if not the conservative bent, its straight-shooting unwillingness to bend in the face of local interests covering local towns. And I was wondering if you'd consider strengthening your regional correspondence again and bring back the kind of Hayward kind of type of writing.
Yeah, and Mark Hayward's still there, by the way.
Yes. Mark is. Gary isn't. Gary hailed from the Keene area. I have an ad in the paper, and I'm happy to say it online. I'm looking for a North Country correspondent. So if somebody knows of somebody, they can contact me at publisher@unionleader.com, because we've been without a steady one. Charlie talked me into combining things up there, and we had a great one in Lorna Calhoun, and she went straight. Now she's working for the state of New Hampshire.
Well, and I do wonder about that, and thank you so much for the question, Steve. I mean, this gets back to what you were talking about earlier, Charlie. It's such a tough business environment. You're making choices. Maybe you can't afford to have correspondents all over the state, and yet some people really want that, so it's tough.
You've always got limited resources. I was lucky enough to be the managing editor at a time when there were more resources to work with. But even in what now seem to be the glory days, looking back to the 80s, Joe and I would have creative discussions, shall we say, about how
creative
we're going to deploy the troops, where we needed to expand, where we needed to cut back during the bad years. You never have enough. Your readers are always going to want more. Mm. That hasn't changed.
The bad years. Are these the bad years now, given the extreme challenges we see in the newspaper industry? What do you think?
These are tough years. I've never seen like this in my career, certainly.
What do you think, Joe?
I think they're the most challenging that the news business has ever seen. The Union Leader has been fortunate in some ways because we've had a bigger base and a stronger advertising base than other papers and have been able to survive some tough times. But I think we're going through very radical changes now, as is everybody in the country in the news business.
Well, and just picking up again on Steve's question about he loved the regional correspondents. He lives in Keene, but he liked the Seacoast.
We still have them. We still have somebody in Keene. We still have somebody in the Seacoast. Matter of fact, we have two or three people in the Seacoast, and we have them in central and in southern New Hampshire. I've got two just going after Nashua, the state's second largest city, in sort of a competitive fight with the local paper down there. So we're still giving, I think, the best state picture every day and online that you can get. Radio does a particular way. TV does a particular way. I think the morning paper says, okay, this is what happened, this is what's going to happen next, and we do it statewide.
You know, and as we talk about sort of local coverage versus statewide coverage, and that's a particular expensive challenge, I think, for the Union Leader, because you're trying to do statewide. People want their local coverage as well. Again, Steve said he appreciated that you guys were there to offer a counter to the local newspaper. What about these new hyper-local websites, the Patch websites, Charlie? And they've struggled, too, in recent years.
They simply haven't sold ads. I know there's some very good people from New Hampshire's journalistic world who have joined Patch, but the sites they have tried to put together just have not established a steady readership, a steady revenue flow, or had real impact. And that's disappointing to me. I would like to think that hyperlocal could be done, hyperlocal meaning journalism that focuses as a good old weekly newspaper would have on one or two or three towns, really giving the nitty-gritty down what's happening in the schools, the rest. It seemed to a lot of us 5-10 years ago, that might be the future. That might be the way that journalism could rediscover its roots and reconnect with community and advertisers. Patch, however, just doesn't seem to be making it.
Well, this has been real interesting, guys. And we've started with the Civil War and mm-hmm. Lincoln getting assassinated, all the way up to the super challenging times of the internet world, and how, you know, your paper's kind of been through it all, 150 years. What do you think, Joe? I mean, what's the legacy? I asked other people this hour, but I haven't asked you yet. 150 years.
I think it's a good legacy. It's a legacy of New Hampshire is a small state, and it's still got one area code, and the union leader tells New Hampshire's story and New Hampshire people. New Hampshire's a proud state, and the state's largest and only statewide newspaper is proud to be a part of it. And I think that's the legacy. And the colorful people and publishers aside, I think that we have told the basic news in a fair way over 150 years, and we'll continue to do so.
Well, here's an email from Matthew that came in. I disagree with the union leader's editorial stance. Still, I read their local news coverage online, particularly when I am overseas. They have the best local coverage. So there's that local coverage angle again. Charlie Perkins, real quick, when's the book coming out?
The book will be out next month. And the union leader, both on his website and in print, will have ways for you to purchase it. And I hope you do. It's just in time for Christmas.
And it's New Hampshire, 150 years again, looking at the headlines, stories over that time period, as told by the union leader.
Correct.
And some great pictures in there from what I saw in the preview you sent me yesterday.
I think your listeners will like it.
Thank you very much, Charlie, for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Charlie Perkins, an editor at the Union Leader for almost 30 years, currently managing partner of North Village Media. Joe McQuaid, good to have you. And I guess I can say happy birthday, right?
Happy birthday twice, 150, and my dad's Sunday News just turned 67 on Sunday.
All right. Well, happy birthday, and thanks for being here. Joe McQuaid, publisher and president of the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is John Barrett. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, is the American political system broken? A week into a government shutdown with a looming debt ceiling crisis and politicians rooted in their positions, many people wonder if we've become partisan to a fault, with both sides refusing to contemplate compromise. We'll look at how we got here and whether we've run out of solutions. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and then join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
NHPR 958 and the Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from New England College School of Graduate and Professional Studies, now in the heart of Concord, offering an MBA beginning October 21st, nec.edu. And the Diabetes and Endocrinology Center at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, providing comprehensive diabetes care to patients across southeastern New Hampshire. FrisbeeHospital.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. In the week since the launch of insurance exchanges, a centerpiece of the new health care law, nearly 9 million Americans have visited the federal health care website. Thousands more have visited online exchanges run by the states.